No, it's great to be here. And, of course, a normal thank you to the organizers, especially Mustafa, who's done such a great job. No. Maybe I misunderstood the assignment. I'm going to be talking about... I'll wait. You're cutting into my questions. No, really. To all the organizers, it's been a wonderful couple of weeks, and I can't wait to come back in a couple of weeks for the end of the workshop. my next joke was going to be, I might have misunderstood the assignment, because I'm going to be talking about the transition from inflation to the Big Bang. So, man. Thank you, Ed. This is a slicing of papers that have to do with thinking about incorporating gravity into general relativity. It is not a complete reference list to the things I'm going to talk about. And there's so many of you, especially those of you in the audience, who have contributed to building up this work. As many of you have said, it's wonderful to be surrounded with so many of your collaborators. In that vein, though, there are people I've been working with on this topic that aren't here. There's my group from Case Western, Glenn Starkman, who I think many of you know, Jim Mertens, who's just moving to Washington University in St. Louis, and Chi Chen, who's on the job market right now, if you need a postdoc who's interested in some of these questions. The four of us mainly do things in the late universe. For the early universe, I've been working mostly with my Kenyan undergrads, Avery Tissue, who's now working with Rob Caldwell at Dartmouth, and Catherine, who will be graduating next year. But I have a big group. I have a lot of undergrads that work with me, and I want to remind those of you who don't think about liberal arts colleges that science gets done in all sorts of places, and there's been a lot of meaningful contributions from people who are in this room and people who've been in this room, like Zach, who gave a great talk on Monday. I just want to point out a couple that are coming through the pipeline to be graduate students soon. Gwyneth and Rand have been working on Schrodinger Poisson stuff. This is sadly the topic that I've sort of worked the most on and haven't published anything. Specific apologies to Chanda in that regards. Allegra Fass, who's also a junior who's been working with modified gravity and compact objects, and then some sophomores who are getting started with me too. And they're actually thinking about a lot of different things. Okay, so why am I going to talk about gravity? And it's funny to say that in this group. Rachel actually got me earlier today to say that I don't work in gravity, but I think I do. you don't remember that? No. Maybe it was a dream. Anyway, but the gravity I'm going to be talking to you about is actual general relativity. Okay, this is a gravity that seems to do really well in describing the natural world and the universe, right? There was this. Many of you heard of this LIGO thing, for example. Precision tests of gravity are overwhelmingly consistent with the observations of the universe we have. The predictions of general relativity don't seem to have much room for misinterpretation, except for the fact that nobody seemed to tell the universe, right? If you just have general relativity, we have a timeline of the history of the universe that seems so simple, that starts with a zero-volume initial condition and has all of these periods, some of which create matter and galaxies and puppies. But our predictions of the FLRW model turn out not to be so great as our precision tests of cosmology because, of course, we have three, as I like to say, epicycles that we have to add to this in order to make it consistent with our observations, right? Inflation or something else. Dark matter and dark energy, and that's why all of us are here to try to understand this problem. The route that I'm going to be talking about, and I think, you know, I'm going to give you some heinous expressions in a little while, but I'm going to start this whole discussion by talking about something totally ridiculous, so that unless you were at my talk at Texas in December, you haven't heard me say these words before. I want to talk about nonlinear physics as being an open opportunity, as being a place where we might look to solve some of these problems, to reconcile this huge gap between the fact that gravity works and gravity doesn't work, that GR works and GR doesn't work. And so my pitch is first going to be to remind us of two things about nonlinear physics. One is that it does mean things are, if you linearize, it does mean that things are small. And so nonlinear physics automatically means that the things that are small are not so small anymore, right? I think we all agree on that. The one that we tend not to remember so much is the fact that in a nonlinear system, suddenly you're going between modes, right? That power gets moved between modes. And I'm gonna challenge us not to use phrases that I use all the time, like the problem became nonlinear at some scale. That doesn't make sense, right? Because as soon as you become nonlinear, all of the modes are coupled to each other. The problem becomes nonlinear. And so the ridiculous thing I want to talk about is the cosmologist golf ball. Okay? So I could take a vote here, right? But when you teach about projectile motion, you teach that what's the only thing important in projectile motion? What's the only quality of the golf ball that's important? No. Not what we teach projectile motion. No. Right? G. Right? That's the only thing that matters. Then you linearize it, and now Pete wants to say, you talk about surface area. Laminar flow is a linear operator, right, where the resistance is proportional to the velocity. Okay, cosmologist stops there, right, and you end up with the conclusion that as soon as you do anything to this ball, it's not going to go as far. Then you hit a golf ball, and you hit a golf ball that has dimples, and suddenly the golf ball with dimples goes twice as far, hundreds of meters further, on a scale that's not at all comparable to the golf ball scale or the dimple scale. And so as a cosmologist, you say, there's a dark energy on the golf ball that pushes it twice as far. Right? And we do this because that has solved some of our problems in the past. But turbulence makes the golf ball go further in a way that's inexplicable using the language of linearized physics. Same thing with these little things on the side of the airplane, right, that reduce fuel use. These things are just a couple of orders of magnitude smaller than their unperturbed counterpart, and they have effects that cannot be captured by linear physics. And so I don't know, when I hit a problem that becomes not nonlinear, not on a scale, but when I hit a problem that becomes nonlinear, I have to ask myself, what is the answer going to be, right? I can't guess it before I do the problem. So we started getting interested in this in the late universe because, of course, any self-respecting person would say that properties are in a certain Hubble volume are uncorrelated to properties in another Hubble volume. That's a foundational aspect of our field. But as soon as we go one level smaller than that, we average over that volume, right? And so we go from it would be ridiculous not to average to be it's ridiculous to average. In a very discontinuous way. And so if the Hubble horizon today is like 4,000 megaparsecs, and I have things on order that are only, that I have power on scales that are only a couple orders of magnitude separate from that, I start to feel like there might be golf ball effects that enter into that problem. Okay? Now, I'm not going to talk about the late universe very much today, although again, that's where we really started thinking about this, because we're thinking about dark energy. But if I think about inflation, the scale of the problem, right, the Hubble scale, is of order, say, M inverse, right? But all the crap that we've been talking about is also order M inverse. Maybe this is 0.5 M inverse, or maybe this is 10 M inverse, but I'm talking about things that aren't separated by huge scales. And so if nonlinear physics becomes important, right, I think we have to do the problem to find out what the answer is. So can nonlinear physics help explain the great mysteries of the universe? So what do we do? What do all those people in that picture and I, and of course Mustafa and Danny and Ed and Richard and Nathan and Zach and Pete, what do we all do with this, right? We take our problems, we take all of our nonlinear operators, and we put them on a grid so that we can do the stupid thing often and quickly, right? And my group developed this code called Gabe, which is named after our late dog, who that evolves scalar fields in a homogeneous universe. There's lots of nonlinear physics in the source term, but nothing in gravity. The first step we took was to add a Newtonian potential to this so that we were talking about linearized gravity, right? This is a great way to start to understand whether a problem becomes nonlinear in a certain sector is to assume that it's linear and look for that to break down. How we do that is a way, I think it's pretty careful, but it's pretty straightforward. We linearize Einstein's equations, we linearize the equations of motion of the field, and then we solve this, it's actually two Poisson equations that we have to solve on every time step in order to get what the Newtonian potential looks like, and then we have a set of coupled differential equations that we can evolve. It's better, easier, of course, to do that in momentum space. I'm going through this a little bit quickly. Stop me. I teach a lot, right? So I'm used to people yelling and throwing things, especially Zach. He's not even going to say anything to that. Richard, yeah.
No.
Oh. This isn't my defense. some things we can do with that is we can apply this, you know, to preheating, where I have the Newtonian potential in the colorful contours and the density contrast in the black and white contour plot behind it, and we see that there are structures that form and the potential becomes non-zero. In this case, it's something 10 to the minus 4, perhaps a little bit more interesting, and we talked about this during Mustafa's talk. And I think Richard's going to be maybe talking a little bit about something like this later. But, you know, if I have non-topological objects like oscillons or solitons that form, I also get some figures there. More recently, and really it only started working last year, we were able to add full numerical relativity to this code. And that's sort of something that I want to, that's sort of what I want to tell you about today, although I guess I'm already halfway through my time. So when you're a graduate student, when I was a graduate student, and thinking about how to incorporate metric perturbations, thanks to Richard, into our simulations, of course, what you want to do is what we do with all of our differential equations, is we calculate the full set of differential equations, we put them into Mathematica, we hit ndSolve, right, and we get an answer out. I did this a couple years ago. I let it run for about 2 weeks. It doesn't return anything, right? And of course, now this is just a ridiculous thing. We know the story of how general relativity actually became something that could be numerically viable. It took insight into the problem in order to cast it into something that that had equations of motion that were solvable, right? Or had equations of motion, I should say, that were stable, that were friendly to the numerical procedure. And I like to also, you know, point out that one of the authors here, Thomas Baumgart, is a friend of mine, but also teaches at a liberal arts college. So there's a great connection between the places I work, the places we work, and numerical relativity. The key to the stabilization of general relativity on the lattice was started in the ADM composition, ADM decomposition, right? I want to be able to evolve a space-time. Right, I want to evolve the space-time by taking spatial hypersurfaces and letting them step through time. So it's a good idea to make time special and then to have some spatial metric on my spatial hypersurfaces. That part seemed pretty obvious. But what wasn't so obvious is how to break up the Einstein's equation so that you ended up with a system that looked more like a wave equation. Okay? And again, I promised you heinous equations. You're gonna miss the golf ball. That is, you're going to miss me talking about golf balls because the next two slides are a little bit painful. As a cosmologist, the two degrees of freedom, or the two explicit things that we evolve, are the spatial metric and the extrinsic curvature on these three-dimensional hypersurfaces. To me, it's the local volume and the local expansion rate. Right? So these are the quantities that we're used to, but we can't call them that because there's nothing averaged in this problem. It's a purely local theory. That was supposed to look better. There are a bunch of differential equations. It was supposed to be dramatic. Anyway, let me just give the punchline of this. Equations of this sort don't matter as long as you trust me that there are equations. But there are more than you'd think there would be, right? So the magic, it's not magic at all, but the strategy behind BSSN formalism, strategy behind doing numerical relativity, is that you evolve more than you have to so that the equations look a little bit better. And so you end up taking a combination of the Christoffel coefficients, and you treat those as an independent parameter, and then you evolve all those things together. Those of us who've done some gauge field work, we often use the same trick. When you have a differential constraint, rather than imposing it, you evolve everything and then check that differential constraint over time. Okay. Are we happy with this? I should have a little voting system. In class, we do. Happy for one, not happy for two. I do. This is Jim Merton's joke, so you can throw the things at him. The question is the universe one of these problems that gets harder with general relativity, or is it one of these problems that gets easier? Right? And I think I'm going to try to argue that we actually live over here, right? That we're actually in a place, because we're not ignoring things, we can actually ask questions that before we had to approximate. This is what an equation of motion looks like before we put it in the code. Our group motto is heinous but finite. For this reason, my jokes are not landing with this group. It's too late in the conference. No, it's not my jokes. Okay. So Andre gave a wonderful introduction to preheating on Monday. I had some slides prepared, and so in the spirit of every great talk, I'm going to give them anyway. But this is the picture that we have in mind. Preheating has a couple of different phases. This is the inflaton oscillating here. These are the variances of the two fields. I want to introduce you to this plot because I'm going to be showing a lot of variance plots as a proxy for things going on. If a variance plot goes up, crap is happening. Okay, that's the test. So during the real parametric resonance part, the chi field, which here is red, is being exponentially amplified on certain wavelengths. Nonlinear fun is happening. At some point, we get to the second regime where back reaction starts. It's not gravitational back reaction, but the phi field starts to feel inhomogeneous. And then we enter this place that some of us would call thermalization. Some of us would call it thermalization behind closed doors. And I guess I said it to the camera, but some stage at which you start to thermalize.
Okay?
There's no graph. I want to walk us through what you expect to happen in the scenario that Andre talked about, but in the language that I'm going to use, because we have to. One of the lessons of general relativity, as we all tell our students when we teach that class, right, is that in general relativity you have to ask the right questions, right? So I just want to get used to these plots. This is my movie. The homogeneous field on the right is the inflaton. Field on the left, I don't have the pretty three-dimensional box, but you see it starts to get bumpy, and there's sort of a characteristic size of that initial stage, and so you believe me that only certain wavelengths are excited, and blah, blah, blah. Things happen. So we started with preheating, not only because it's something that I think a lot about, and it's something that I've spent a number of years looking into, but also because preheating has certain expectations, right? There are certain guesses. There are certain predictions about what might be the role of gravity during preheating, and I'm glad to have Richard here because he and Raphael, right, along with James, wrote a paper about what might happen to the homogeneous mode in a universe that's undergoing preheating. I guess that was a couple of years ago now, but Nathan, who's also here, and Richard, as well as someone who's not here, Sean. Recently came out with a different model. I'm not really going to talk about this, but I believe Richard's going to talk about it tomorrow. But I want to recognize that I think that there's an interplay here, that we're making guesses as to what might happen, adding gravitational effects. And when we talk about things like the breakdown fragmentation, right? Thank you. Right. When we talk about fragmentation, these are questions that enter the nonlinear regime. There also was recently a paper about the fact that this instability is dangerous enough to create primordial black holes during a normal preheating phase, right? So there were predictions as to what might happen in nonlinear gravity, and so it was an obvious first step to take to try to figure out whether or not these things actually happen. Of course, it goes without saying that these things were looking at the Newtonian potential and seeing where it gets big. And what happens when the Newtonian potential gets big is all that we know is we've entered the nonlinear phase, right? And so you have to hire me or one of the other people in the room to go and do the lattice simulation. Okay. So this is a preheating simulation with the Newtonian potential turned on with linearized gravity. And what I'm showing on the left side is I'm showing a plot of the max and min of the Newtonian potential as a function of time. And what's neat is, of course, you see that as I move to the right, the Newtonian potential is getting bigger, right? Or this is the variance of the Newtonian potential. It's the max and min of the Newtonian potential. So the Newtonian potential, the magnitude of it is getting bigger, right, as I go to the right, because things are happening. And it mirrors the stages of preheating that we talked about a few minutes ago, right? That once I start to see things happening in the fields, once I start to generate delta rho's, I generate things in the Newtonian potential. And what I see is that, though, this effect turns out to be box size dependent, right? And I think this is the statement that many of us have been talking about, that once you get to Hubble scales, or once your once relevant modes enter the horizon, then those modes have a larger effect on the Newtonian potential, and they cause it to become larger. Okay? And right here, this tops out at about 0.01 for a box size of 11. I'm going to go up to box sizes up to 20. To put this in context, 2 is H at the end of inflation, H inverse. Okay, so, but you'll love these numbers by the time I'm done. On the right-hand side, I'm plotting something that I like to think about, because what I'm looking at here is I'm looking at the longest wavelength that the box can resolve divided by the box size. Yeah, Richard. Oh, this is n squared phi squared inflation. With a phi chi. It's a canonical preheating. I'm sorry. Yeah, I should have mentioned that. Yeah. Exactly, yeah. Go ahead. Yeah. And this is solving the Poisson equation, well, both. So it's not the non-relativistic Poisson equation. So I solve for the extrinsic curvature term by taking the divergence of the stress energy tensor. Yeah.
Suppose you did ask the same question, but you did not include the impact on the fields. So you treated gravity passively.
Yes.
Did the answers change?
I don't think very much. I'm guessing, because I don't remember anything, and I don't have the plot up here, but I don't think it changes very much. That's a good question. So this plot over here has this ratio, and why I like it is because there's a 1 on this plot, where I can see when the longest wavelength comes inside the horizon. Okay. Now, I'm using the variance as our proxy for stuff going on in the universe, and I mentioned that that's not precisely the thing that we should be looking at. The variance is highly sensitive to short wavelength fluctuations of the field. When you use a numerical relativity method, you have more power in those short wavelengths because you're doing finite differencing. When I do perturbation theory, I'm talking about I'm solving a Poisson equation, and so it's just cleaner in those wavelengths. So their direct comparisons are going to be a little bit hard. But the direct comparison that convinced me finally that the code was working was when we decomposed both the Newtonian potential that I get from solving the Poisson equation to the Bardeen potentials that I reconstruct from the full numerical relativity in the regime where we trust Newtonian gravity, linearized gravity, that those spectra lie on top of each other. Okay. Now you're going to say this don't look like, but the majority of the physics that we're interested in happens in this regime. The dotted lines are synchronous gauge in the numerical relativity simulations, which we wanted to see this peak because synchronous gauge suffers from really being not a very good gauge to use when looking at horizon-sized objects. So the fact that the gray and the blue and the black all line up so well in the regime of interest is a sign that we can trust this. And so now I'm going to go back to showing you plots of the variance so that I don't have to decompose it like this. It's a log plot, yeah. Oh, sorry. Yeah. So the black is the spectrum, the dimensionless power spectrum of the Newtonian potential from a linearized gravity run. The blue is a 1 plus log or it's a slicing in general relativity that's good for black holes, and then the gray are the 2 Bardeen potentials from synchronous gauge. That's right, yeah, 0, this is in the middle of the preheating period, and this is at the end of the simulation.
So the peak is a gauge artifact.
This peak is a gauge artifact. The real question to ask is whether in this simulation you violate the linearized Einstein's equations, right, which is something that we wrote a paper on for the late universe stuff. But the question about when you can't trust linearized gravity isn't when the Newtonian potential becomes large, but it's to do the full problem and find out whether or not the linearized version of it violates the linearized Einstein's equations. So once I get to a bigger box, what I see is that the Newtonian runs crap out, right? And it craps out at just about 1, right? So for this large box that has longer wavelength modes, once the H scale mode comes inside the horizon, then the Newtonian run can't run anymore because the size of the Newtonian potential became bigger than 1/4, and therefore a sign change in the equations of motion. Okay? And that was not unexpected because we knew that everything we saw led to the fact that we can't really understand what it means to have a large Newtonian potential in these problems where the Newtonian potential becomes large. And now we can ask ourselves, in this regime, does general relativity give us craziness? Are there black holes, right? This is what we expected. This is when we knew the linearized analysis was going to break down. Does it actually do anything? yeah, go ahead. Oh, it's a periodic box. So, yeah, so I can do it for all the modes in the box. Yeah. So, what happens in this... sorry, this is only for L equals 11. I should have the 20s on here. But for these three runs, what I'm showing you is I'm showing you the variance of the phi field and the chi field for all three different types of simulations. And what you can see that growing of the variance of the, or you can see something that looks like physics in the gray lines here, because once I get to this box size, I start to see the variance of phi starting to grow. But when I do the problem in full numerical relativity, it doesn't feel like that's real anymore, right? Because the blue lines sort of retreat back to the red lines. Yeah, go ahead, Andre.
Technical question, but important one. What's the time relation scheme? Do you have dissipation as usually done in numerical black holes?
I can, but I'm not.
So second order counting?
It's a Runge cut of 2. Oh, sorry, Runge cut of 4.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's a couple of lines.
I'm sorry? Yes. Yep. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. But yeah. No. Technically speaking, we have Kreis-Ollinger dissipation that's allowed in there. We have some constraint damping terms that are in there. But it turns out we didn't need them. Okay. And so some of the things that we did that were new is actually the initial conditions are set by perturbation theory where we trust it. That actually satisfies the constraints well enough. Maybe this is question and answer stuff. So I go to this box of 20. Right, where the Newtonian simulation broke, and I say to myself, can I find any black holes? How do I find black holes in a BSSN simulation? I look for places where the lapse goes to 0. Okay, because if the clock stops somewhere on the grid or near some point on the grid, then I'm going to find something that starts to resemble a black hole. In these moving puncture coordinates, I should be able to create them. I can put them in by hand, and they're stable in the same slicing. And what I'm plotting here is the variance of the lapse, and it only gets up to 10 to the minus 3. Now, I could show you a whole plot of the entire lapse. The lapse isn't doing anything silly here. Okay, the lapse is fine. So there are no black holes. The simulation seems to run fine.
And lapse is set in which
range? It's set in harmonic slicing.
Okay.
Yeah, it's the very initial slice looks like co-moving Newtonian gauge, but then it evolves in 1 plus log slicing from there. No, go ahead. I hear questions don't take off time. This is the last stable slice from the biggest box I can run in perturbation theory. I'm going. The biggest box I can run in perturbation theory compared to the relativistic run, right? And you'd be hard pressed to convince me that there's much difference, actually, when I calculate something like rho on these hypersurfaces. Well, so if you talk about having a black hole, you have to create a horizon. Okay? If the lapse goes to 0, you can't have a geodesic inside that horizon that can leave.
I just thought that was a gauge dependent statement.
No, because you can actually draw, you can start inside that horizon, and you can try to draw a world line leaving at the speed of light, and it never gets out because the clock stops. Yeah. The lapse itself is pure gauge, but you can use it to find where the horizons are. Yeah. Oh, I'm at the end. So I do have, by the way, I played the game where I have 8 more slides, 4 to answer Danny's question and 4 to answer, I think, a question that Mustafa asked me. So I'm waiting for you two to ask that later, but I hope at least. So what I presented, I think, is the work from that paper that Avery and I wrote. where we took a first stab at trying to find out if there really were catastrophes during preheating that come from the fact that the Newtonian potential gets large for certain box sizes. And the answer seems to be no. Right? So the question is, so Tom, but you said this whole thing about the golf balls and we'd never know and it turns out everything's fine, right? But so in this case, everything is fine. Right, but this method is the only method that we can use if we really want to find out if compact objects do form naturally out of these processes. Okay. So I talked about this just for a second, but of course that's coupled to the fact that you have to ask the right questions. Right, once we start seeing things like the lapse going to zero somewhere on the lattice, or we start to see things that don't look like you can trust our intuition from perturbation theory, you then have to make sure that you do the right calculations. So for example, in the late universe, if you want to talk about anything in an inhomogeneous spacetime, you actually have to propagate photons through it in order to recreate observables. And then I try to end every talk by reminding us that the scientists that probably solve these great problems are not going to look like the scientists that taught us how to solve these problems, because our methods aren't working so well. So as you hire my students, or you hire each other, or you do what you're hiring, I want you to really think about the fact that backgrounds do contribute to creative paradigm shifts. And as I said, I have 8 more slides, but I'll let those be prompted.
All right, so I think they'll Andre, you've had a good go, so maybe we'll come back to you at the end. So Danny.
Okay, thanks for the very nice talk. So your conclusion that we don't produce primordial black holes in these setups, would you say it's really related to the setup itself, to the physics of this scenario, or you really think that we should change the prescription that people use when they use linearized gravity in order to give a threshold, you know, for what is the relevant amplitude of the Newtonian potential I should be concerned about?
Great question. I would be shooting myself in the foot if I said that this weren't model dependent, right? I mean, we spent 3 years writing this code. Thanks, mostly to Keith. But we spent 3 years writing this code, right? And it's clear that what we wanted to look at first was a model that we knew enough about. I mean, we've been studying this for decades, right? Now, I think we knew that these instabilities existed, and the Newtonian potential got big, but I don't think, you know, when we've been talking about primordial black holes, we haven't thought about this model as the one that actually creates them. Right, so Zach gave this great talk where we actually have these great tachyonic instabilities near the horizon. The Newtonian potential gets big there quickly, right? And so that's the natural next thing to do. Of course, embedding gauge fields in this is going to take us a couple more months, but surely this is a model by model problem, right? Maybe after we do 10, we might say something generically about the fact that the angular momentum inside the box is the thing that's stopping the black holes from forming, but we're not at that stage yet. I didn't say that. You're not going to ask your question about the oscillons? Okay.
So Tom, just to be clear about this, it's a Newtonian code that blows up, or like when you have a Newtonian, you're doing Newtonian gravity on a scale that's well outside of the horizon when you start. I mean, it's another way of looking at this and saying, like, this is clear, like what you're doing with the GR code is, like, whatever gauge problem you had that's causing it to blow up is controlled by the fact that you're working in full general relativity. And so the apparent, like we would have guessed that if you're doing Newtonian collapse on a scale that's outside the horizon, I mean, that's got to make you nervous, right?
Well, so, the horizon naturally comes out of the framework, right? So when we do linearized gravity, we're solving a non-local problem.
Yeah.
But when we do this, we're not solving a non-local
problem. I guess that's what I mean, is like no one ever really thought if you just do Newtonian gravity and you see collapse, like we can't, like in some sense this is proving that what you know is going to be a problem if you do the Newtonian case should not be a problem when you do the general relativistic case, because we know that the black holes would form locally well inside of the horizon, so you wouldn't like I'm trying to just get a sense of, like, you weren't coming into this expecting to see black holes in some sense. You were coming into this thinking that the GR was going to tame the problem that you were seeing.
I came into this hoping to see black holes, right? But no, I actually, I think I have to push back a little bit, because what I read, right? And is that we have curvature perturbations that are set by inflation. They come back in the horizon and they form a black hole at the horizon size, right? That's the story that we tell. And we set a threshold for what the size of that mode has to be, right? My point is not that those don't create primordial black holes, right? My point is that it's a nonlinear problem. And so what I'm setting up is the argument that we are able to do that using a code like this.
Right, I guess the kind of black hole that you would see it preheating now, your expectation is that would be one of the, at the length scale, that was kind of maximally pumped by the resonance, because that's your, that's, you know, where your delta rho over rho is kind of spikiest. But getting the one that's driven by the primordial spectrum is just that I've got, you know, like a spectrum that's been artificially enhanced, so there is often I get a particularly overdense horizon, and as soon as it gets in you know, kind of causal contact with itself, then it collapses pretty quickly.
Sure, and I'm going to say that, you know, as somebody who's trying to sell this, right, I'm not yet convinced that that happens, right? That even if we have a delta rho over rho, or we have some distribution that looks like what people study in critical collapse and other numerical simulations, we have structure on different scales that are not in those codes. And therefore, when it's a nonlinear problem, you actually have to consider those. And I think that's the point that I'm trying to make. I don't know what's going to happen in these other simulations.
No. I mean, as far as I'm concerned, you're preaching to the choir on this. I think this is the right way to do this. But I'm just trying to get a sense of like if we had. I mean, there are people who have looked at preheating and said, oh, I get these really big perturbations and they form black holes.
Yeah.
Now my impression was that those were black holes that were well inside of the horizon. They weren't primordial black holes in the kind of Carr and Hawking sense.
Okay, so I happen to have some slides. Okay. So I want to say that this is just something that Zach helped me with in the last couple of days, because a question came up during the workshop last week. Okay, so you have some spectrum, they come in, you have a matter-dominated universe, those modes grow, right? And so we saw that in the linearized gravity picture, and this plot is thanks to Zach, that we do actually get the same crashing that we see in the preheating simulations. But in BSSN, and again, this green line, the line that stopped is not because it stopped, it's because I started these runs 36 hours ago, and the bigger boxes run faster, that I see, if I wait a long time, I see that the power or the variance is growing, that there is, that the universe is becoming bumpier over time, but I haven't yet made it out to a redshift where I expect that to say collapse, and the variance of alpha here is still pretty small.
What was BSSN?
That's the numerical relativity. Yeah.
This is just single field.
No, just a single massive field.
Single massive field. So
yeah.
The delta rho over rho is growing as a scale factor here?
It should be. Yeah.
I was asking. Yeah. So where do I see that?
You wouldn't see that here.
Okay.
Yeah, but yeah.
Because also the gravitational potential, if it's a matter-dominated universe inside the horizon, that should be roughly constant.
Exactly. Yeah.
And is it?
I don't. You've been with me, okay. Right? We've had 8 talks a day, so okay. I haven't like I ran. I started this and I made this plot, right? Okay. So, but what I see here is I see the universe getting bumpier. And I see it growing as I expected.
Alpha
it to.
Is what? Sorry.
Alpha is the lapse. This is the variance of the lapse.
I better give Andre a turn.
Well, I have one quick question and one other question. Quick question: how much slower?
Oh my God, slower! Yeah.
Yes. Oh my God, yeah. Is like what factor of 10 or more?
Okay, so that orange line is a 128. No, the orange line is a 64 cube simulation that's been running for about 36 hours.
Okay.
And the blue line is a 128 that's been running a little bit longer than that. I'd expect for this in a Newtonian case to take 5 minutes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So,
yes.
Yeah, many orders of magnitude.
Yes.
Okay. Now, part of that is I'm taking a lot of Fourier transforms for output and stuff, and it's in debug mode and all that crap,
yes.
but many orders of magnitude longer.
Yeah. Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I was just wondering about it. Like, it looks much harder. But as a more sort of, you know, harder question is just how long can you integrate until your constraints start drifting?
Oh, great question. Right, so I mentioned that the power of BSSN is that you you have more parameters than you need, and you have to check constraints. And so we know when to stop trusting the system, right? So for everything that I've shown here, the constraint violation is 1 part in 10 to the 5 or better.
But your potential is like 10 to the minus 5, right?
Yes, but that's okay, right? Because what this took me a while to, you know, like Dr. Strangelove, right? You have to learn to love the bomb, right?
Okay.
The key is that the noise in a numerical relativity simulation is there. It's just bounded. And so if you have constraint violation, you don't have to make it zero. You just can't let it grow. And so if you pass a convergence test and the constraints aren't growing, then you extract the IR physics from that, and that's the answer. And that's how numerical relativity works. And for those of us who've been worried about, you know, energy conservation all this time in our field simulations, that's a little bit, it's a little bit jarring, but it turns out you can get the physics from those two tests.
Okay, well, we should talk about this offline, because this is not going to be fast.
Yeah.
But it's cool.
How about anybody not in the numerical community? Do you want to know what happened to oscillons? I have not come to oscillons. So, yeah, thank you. So I had a student last year who's now at CMU, Patrick, so Danny asked, what would we expect the size of the Newtonian potential to be if oscillons are here, if you remember at the end of Mustafa's talk, right? And so it turns out I looked in the box, and we have an axiom monodromy run where we can compare what the oscillons look like without Newtonian gravity and with Newtonian gravity. If you look at these two pictures, you can just tell how dramatically different they are. Thank you. Right. It's really hard to tell any qualitative differences. Maybe I'd see orbits. Actually, if I had a movie of this, I'd have loved to have showed it to you. But again, we've had 8 talks today, so I haven't had a chance to look for things. But if I compare this figure of merit that we use for oscillons, how much energy is trapped in the oscillons as a function of time, for 2,000 M inverse, which you divide that by 6, and you get the number of oscillations of the field, there's a tiny bit of difference. So they're either a little bit heavier, or there are more of them. But there is some effect that's coming from Newtonian gravity. But as I passed very quickly on one of the first slides, the Newtonian potential here gets to be about 10 to the minus 3. Is that worth going to BSSN? Of course we're going to go to BSSN and do it, right? We spent a lot of money building the software to see whether or not is this going to have any nonlinear effects? We're guessing probably not, but it's still something worth trying. Of course, there's a recent paper out that said if you go to an unphysical regime, this can become 10 to the minus 2, 10 to the minus 1, and then perhaps we need to look at it there. Yeah, Danny. Yeah.
Sorry.
I feel like so we've had 8 talks a day for the last 100. So we just haven't had time to think about those things yet. This all came out of your question on Monday. Yeah. Yeah. All the numerical people are asking questions. I'm trying to convince the perturbation theory people. No? Anybody? No throwing things? You're all convinced? Do I get the job?
So I think, Tom, when we tried to just passively extract the Newtonian potential that was also of order 10 to the minus 3, when we do it with the effective sort of Schrodinger-Poisson thing, it's also roughly the same order. And here it's also the same order. So I think it's reasonably convincing that all of these three things are giving roughly the same answer as we should expect. But the interesting thing will be in the long timescale evolution.
Mm-hmm.
Of what happens to these objects as they clump together, what do they do? Do they do something interesting in the long run? Again, it's unlikely that in the simulation that it is unlikely something dramatic should happen.
Yes.
So it would be interesting to see if the long timescale evolution from the Newtonian thing and this one are somehow different or not.
Yeah, I think it's worth just flashing this just so that we can see that, you know, the Newtonian potential is always compared to 1.
Yeah.
Right? And so the only time that that's not true is when it's compared to H. Right, and that's a statement of how relativistic the problem is. So, I think that this is why we don't what Mustafa is talking about by passively having this is to calculate the Newtonian potential but not include these terms in the equations of motion. It's not surprising that that doesn't have a huge difference. It will matter more, right, as it gets bigger.
Why are the potentials the same, by the way?
Because this is a stepping stone. So to evolve both of them, one of them has to be done dynamically. right? And this is just a Poisson equation, so if I'm going to do relativity anyway, you know, have one step rather than two.
Any more questions for Tom? Everyone's just happy with this? No, we're all good? All right, well, let's
do you want me
Tom.
To put it, I can put it in ADS-CFT.
Great talk.